It's, so why are we at war again? Why are, you know, up now towards 1 million Lebanese being forced out of their homes, many of them sleeping on the streets, many of them without access to medical care or even aid that they got in the previous war? So it's raising a lot of fear. And I wrote about the Gaza playbook because what a lot of people are seeing in this, in the kind of pattern of Israeli attacks and orders to leave areas, is concern about ethnic cleansing. There's a fear, and some far-right Israeli officials and people close to the government are already saying that Israel will want to seize territory. Yeah, so that's raising a lot of concern of, will Lebanon as a state even survive after this war? And you know, even as President Trump is out here saying perhaps he'd want to rein in the Iran war, given its broader consequences for energy infrastructure, the Trump administration, from my sources on the inside, is basically paying zero attention to this broadening war in Lebanon, which is so worrying for a country that's already been so beleaguered.
Akbar Shahed Ahmedou, want to thank you so much for being with us, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. We'll link to your recent articles at democracynow.org. Coming up, we speak to a former Marine arrested, his arm broken, while protesting the war during a Senate hearing. And then we'll talk about a new book, Killers of Roe, my investigation into the mysterious death of abortion rights. We'll speak with the nation's abortion access reporter, Amy Littlefield. Stay with us.
Yesterday I saw you standing there with your hand against the pane, looking out the window at the rain. And I wanted to tell you all your tears were not in vain, but I guess we both knew we'd never be the same.
Peaceable Kingdom by Patti Smith, performed at Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. On our 30th anniversary, which has been rescheduled for March 23rd, Monday at Riverside Church, Patti Smith will be singing again. We'll also be interviewing her. She'll be there along with Michael Stipe, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and other special guests. We'll also be interviewing Angela Davis and others. Coming up on Democracy Now! March 23rd, we'll have a live stream at democracynow.org. And if you had tickets for the February 23rd event, which was put off because of the bomb cyclone, the blizzard that was happening that day, they will be honored on March 23rd. Go to democracynow.org for details. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill last week, a Marine Corps veteran and candidate for Senate in North Carolina suffered a broken arm after he disrupted a Senate hearing to voice his opposition to the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. The veteran, Brian McGinnis, was forcefully pulled through a door by Capitol Police. His arm became stuck in the door and broke. Brian McGinnis interrupted the meeting while Senator Dan Sullivan was speaking. Sullivan's chair of the Armed Services Subcommittee.
Our next witness is the Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Gehring.
Israel is the reason for this war. America does not want to fight this war for Israel. Come on, let's go. America does not want to sell its sons and daughters to war for Israel. Your enemy.
Just a reminder to all our witnesses.
Please stand up as a Marine.
The Capitol Police will escort any protesters out of the hearing room.
No one wants to fight.
We ask for calm in these hearings.
Why are you getting arrested?
Free Palestine, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Palestine will be free.
Oh my God, they broke his arm.
Brian McGinnis remained detained by Capitol Police as he was treated in the hospital for a broken arm. He's now facing charges, including assault on a police officer, resisting arrest, and unlawful demonstration. Brian McGinnis served in Iraq in 2003, a member of Veterans for Peace, running for U.S. Senate from North Carolina on the Green Party ticket. This is to replace the outgoing Senator Tom Tillis. Brian McGinnis joins us now from North Carolina. We're also joined by his attorney, Celano Simmons. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Brian, describe what happened. First of all, why did you go to that Senate hearing?
Good morning, Amy. I'm smiling because I'm excited to be here and meet you, but I'm sad from the headlines that have been sadly going across our screens for the last 2.5 years inside. I'm sad. I went to the hearing to hear what our leaders had to say in regards to war preparedness, and it was not any different from what I would expect from military leaders. They are so separate from the people, so in line with big government and its plans, and which we've been privy to with the last 25 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's just the voice of the people's voice are not being heard with any type of empathy. It's just, full speed ahead with military force. I think the people are tired of that. And that's what the voice I was trying to present at that briefing.
So walk us through that protest on March 4th. What exactly happened? How was your arm broken?
Well, all that I can't speak about too much because of legal reasons. But everybody has seen the video, or a lot of people have seen the video, so it's pretty self-explanatory. Those briefing rooms are customizable. They have removable walls. And so I think my arm got wedged between one of those walls and the door, and with the force being applied, my arm got broke. My hand was completely stuck, and that's how that happened.
Celano Simmons, you're Brian's attorney. Can you explain what the charges are against him?
Yeah, first of all, Amy, thanks for having us. Brian is facing 4 counts. 3 counts of assault on police officers. There are 3 individual named that are law enforcement. The 4th and final count is resisting arrest. He's being charged by the United States government in Washington, D.C. Superior Court. And we're looking forward to having our day in court regarding these matters.
I want to ask you, Brian, as you were being led away, you also said free Palestine. Your wife and kids are Palestinian. You participated in a demonstration in the West Bank in 2024. What is your message to senators on the issue of Israel and Palestine right now?
Their lack of research in the history of Palestine is abhorrent. There's so much knowledge of the military occupation of the Palestinians and the torturous reality they face every day that invades their humanity and their rights. And being under such oppression, it would only be natural for someone to resist or fight back. And this seemingly easy dynamic of life to understand, I am trying to present to Americans in a way, but sadly, the villainization of Islam or Islamophobia or the difference in American and Arab cultures have created such a gap in understanding that it's a challenging thing to do. But I'm not going to stop. Like you said, my wife and children are American Palestinians. And so that brings us very close to home. I myself am an Iraq veteran. I have come a long way from who I was when I was in the service, and then having children and just growing up and watching news and learning. I have a complete different realm of reality and knowledge to contextualize what I've done. And I have a lot of resentment and sadness about what America is doing with our brave sons and daughters in the military.
Republican Senator Tim Sheehy of Montana helped officers remove you, Brian McGinnis, from the hearing. Afterwards, he posted on X, quote, Capitol Police were attempting to remove an unhinged protester from the armed services hearing. He was fighting back. I decided to help out and de-escalate the situation, the Montana Senator Tim Sheehy said. As we wrap up, how do you respond to what Sheehy said? And explain why you've decided to run for Senate to take Tom Tillis's seat, who's retiring.
We have much larger problems at hand. The millions, you know, thousands of children are dying. That's the focus. So I'm not, no ill will towards Mr. Sheehy. Things happen. People have intentions to de-escalate or help situations. And I get that. We all step in and we're imperfect and we're good at sometimes and bad at sometimes. That's neither here nor there. I'm running for Senate to be a voice for the people, representing the Green Party. The Green Party is an established party that's only people run. We do not take corporate sponsors. That's very important because our government has shown to be highly influenced by big money. And the Green Party is not about that. And I was overwhelmed with looking at my email from the support and the genuine support I got from people from all over the world and here in America. And I really want to convince North Carolinians that I'm a genuine person and a good choice to represent the people in our government. And I just, and my experience at Senate this last weekend or last week was just, it showed the wall between the people and the government. And I want to break through that wall for people.
Brian McGinnis, I want to thank you for being with us. Marine veteran arrested, had his arm broken at a Senate hearing last week while protesting the war against Iran, running for Senate in North Carolina on the Green Party ticket. And I want to thank Celeno Simmons, Brian McGinnis's attorney. Coming up, Amy Littlefield, author of Killers of Roe, My Investigation into the Mysterious Death of Abortion Rights, back in 20 seconds.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom.
We who believe in freedom.
We who believe cannot rest until it comes. We who believe.
Song, We Who Believe in Freedom Cannot Rest Until It Comes, by Sweet Honey and the Rock, performing at the 2025 Peace Ball. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at the Killers of Roe. That's the title of a new book by reproductive rights journalist Amy Littlefield, on what she describes as the death of abortion rights in America. The book examines the movement to criminalize abortion in the years and decades before the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Hyde Amendment, which banned federal funding for abortion, which has disproportionately impacted the poor and women of color. Amy Littlefield is the Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent, also a former Democracy Now! Producer. Amy, welcome back to Democracy Now! Congratulations on the publication of your book. Why don't we start off by you talking about the state of reproductive rights in the United States right now.
Thank you, Amy. It's great to be back on the opposite side. Usually I was in the control room. So abortion access today is a landscape that is defined by contradiction. Half of states have some form of restriction on abortion before 24 weeks. More than a dozen states ban abortion outright. And yet, in every year since the Supreme Court overturned the right to abortion, the number of abortions in this country has gone up, which is remarkable. And that's because 8 states allow providers anywhere in those states to ship abortion pills anywhere in the country, including into states where abortion is banned. And they're doing so for free or for very cheap. And so, in a way, abortion, which was
most abortions are done by these pills.
Correct. Today, most abortions are by medication, and that's the ones that we can count. There's more community activists circulating these pills completely under the radar. But that means that today, a woman in rural Mississippi can get an abortion sent to her through the mail by pills from a clinician operating in a blue state like New York or Massachusetts for free. Right to her door, someone who would have had to drive hours and endure waiting periods and all kinds of hurdles in the time before the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And so, in a sense, access has expanded, and yet choice has contracted, right? Because the options have narrowed. Often clinics are off limits because many of them have closed and are not operating in states where abortion is banned. And so, you know, we used to have a landscape where there was choice, there was a right to abortion legally, but access was curtailed because you needed the money to afford it. And now we see the situation where access has expanded, but people's choices really have narrowed, especially when you factor in the legal risk that and the fear that can define seeking an abortion in a state where it's banned.
Talk about the attempts to stop pills being sent to women.
Right. So the most recent one that we've seen is the Trump administration has not acted as quickly as abortion opponents would like to restrict medication abortion, and these pills are circulating freely through the mail. And so
why do you think that is, that they're not acting?
Because abortion rights are super popular, Amy. They are more popular than maybe the New York mayor is one exception, but just about every politician. Abortion rights are more popular than that is a losing issue for Republicans, especially after the Dobbs decision. And so that's why many people think Trump is not touching this issue until after the midterm elections, which tells you everything you need to know about why abortion rights and democracy go hand in hand.
Mm. And talk about what states and what courts the issue of restricting pills are in right now.
That's
what's
right.
The big decision?
So we should get a ruling any day from a federal judge who's looking at Louisiana's request to stop the mailing of abortion pills. And that obviously could disrupt this network that I'm telling you about that's reaching people in corners of the country in Texas and Alabama where abortion wasn't accessible before.
I want to talk about your book. Why'd you call it Killers of Roe?
So, Amy, I was a new mom when it became clear we were going to lose the national right to abortion. And about the only thing I could tolerate, this was COVID times, right, was murder mysteries. That was all I was reading. And I knew that I was going to have to, you know, my years of an abortion reporter told me that people were going to die as a result of Roe v. Wade being overturned. I knew this was going to be a hard story to tell. And it started out as a murder mystery because it was a way to entice myself to tell a really difficult story about women dying preventable deaths as a result of anti-abortion policy. And I knew I was going to have to sit with the killers of Roe, with the men who had brought these policy changes about. And I knew that was going to be a hard task to do. And so the murder mystery was a way for me to look at the hidden figures. It's always the person you least suspect in a murder mystery. And I was talking to those people as I dug into the 50 years of how we lost abortion rights in America.
And what does Agatha Christie have to do with this?
Agatha Christie is my comfort. She's my escape. She got me through adolescence, and she got me through new motherhood. And then it just so happened she got me through the task of, you know, 2 years of reporting on this book to figure out who killed Roe and why.
Your first quote of Agatha Christie is, Miss Marple, the great thing in these cases is to keep an absolutely open mind. Most crimes you see are so absurdly simple.
Right. The crime was simple. They took away women's right to bodily autonomy. And yet the people, as I would learn, were so complicated, right? A twisted alliance of believers and opportunists is what I found as I dug into this history.
Let's talk about one of those complicated characters in your book, former Oregon Senator Bob Packwood. Let's go to a clip from 1985. This is the National Women's Political Caucus presenting Packwood with the Good Guys Award.
Senator Packwood is women's number one ally in the Senate. Senator Packwood, you have touched millions of American lives by your example, by your hard work, your legendary independence and courage. For all of that, we are grateful. So it's my honor to present a Good Guys Award to you, a leader, a fighter, our ally, and our friend, Senator Bob Packwood.
That's Republican Senator Bob Packwood of Oregon, who would leave the Senate in disgrace, having detailed his crimes in his diaries.
Right. 48 women came forward to accuse Packwood, women's greatest ally in the Senate, of sexual misconduct, right? He wrote some really disgusting things in his diaries, which later came to light. The line that was seared into my mind was, if she didn't want me to feather her nest, why did she come into the Xerox room? This was about a woman who had come into the Xerox room to photocopy some papers, presumably, right? So that was his attitude towards women. And yet, he was such a staunch feminist and worked really hard to promote abortion rights and was an ally of Gloria Steinem. And so,
and attacked many Republican rights activists who would come into his office.
Right. Well, accosted seemingly almost every woman who walked into his office he would accost. Pro-choice Republican, super complicated person. And my chapter on Packwood, I flew out to Oregon to interview him. He's in his 90s now, and I interviewed him with his wife. And my chapter starts out with my now five-year-old Tully asking me, is he a good guy or a bad guy? Tully had found my book with Packwood's face on the cover. Is he a good guy or a bad guy? And me trying to answer that question because it's complicated. You know, in cartoons, there's good guys and bad guys, and it's pretty straightforward. In murder mysteries and also in real life, it's a lot more complicated than that.
So here's a clip of another major character in your book, former Maryland Congressmember Bob Bowman, speaking on the McNeil Era Report in 1977 when the Hyde Amendment was being renewed in Congress. He was asked about projections that renewing the ban could result in dozens of maternal deaths.
To mourn the death of 5 or 90 is one thing when 300,000 deaths on the average are being financed by federal funding. Seems to me somewhat disproportionate. A death is just as tragic whether it's a mother or a child, in my view.
That's former Maryland Congressmember Bob Bowman. Talk about him.
So he was one of the hidden figures that I was able to track down and interview behind one of the most defining anti-abortion policies in our history. The Hyde Amendment cut off abortion access for poor women almost 50 years ago and shaped the abortion access landscape in ways that we take for granted today, forced activists to raise millions of dollars each year to pay for people's abortions. Bob Bowman was a super unpopular guy. He was a really conservative member of Congress. He's the one who tapped his more popular colleague, Henry Hyde, on the shoulder and said, why don't you introduce the Hyde Amendment? It didn't work when Bob Bowman did it, but he thought maybe Henry Hyde was this charming, popular guy, and he could get it through instead. Now, in 1980, an FBI investigation found that Bowman had been cruising the streets of Washington, D.C. in a car with congressional plates, picking up men and paying them for sex, one of whom was allegedly a boy of 16. And so Bauman's political career ended at that point. He's been spending the years since writing treatises about offshore tax avoidance. And so that felt very consistent with sort of the wider conservative project, right? The person who helped withhold federal taxpayer funding for abortion went on to try to work against, you know, the ultra wealthy paying any taxes whatsoever.
I saw you at your book launch with Faye Waddleton, the first black leader of the first black president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, youngest ever. She was something like 33 years old when she took office. Her obsession, she said, was the Hyde Amendment because it targeted poorer women and women of color.
That's absolutely right. Faye Waddleton came in with a promise to try to repeal the Hyde Amendment, and she faced a huge backlash, including from within her own organization. And so part of the story of Who Killed Roe is also about Democratic and pro-choice complicity in the fact that the policy that we knew was deadly almost from day one, the policy that cut off abortion access for poor women, endures to this day.
I want to talk about some of the victims. One of the deaths from abortion restrictions that you chronicle in your book is Becky Bell. Let's go to a clip of Becky's mother, Karen, testifying in the Indiana state legislature in 2017, trying to stop Indiana from making it even harder for a minor to get an abortion in Indiana.
September 16, 1988, my little girl, just 17, died of an illegal botched abortion right here in Indianapolis. They never found who did whatever they did to her with dirty instruments. It's been all over the news for years. My husband and I haven't talked for years because it got so dangerous when we were out that people tried to kill us for speaking against this law. I would have voted for the parental consent law like that, being the mom I was back in 1988. I wasn't educated what it meant. I thought, if my daughter, who I love more than anything in the world, doesn't come to me, that law will make her come and I'll take care of her. Well, it's a law that the daughters that love you more than life, they'll die for you.
Karen Bell, mother of Becky Bell. I remember covering her death. Boy, the bell tolls for you. If you'll tell us about Becky Bell.
Becky Bell was a 17-year-old who died because of a parental consent law in Indiana. She got pregnant and told a friend she loved her parents too much to tell them that she needed an abortion. She didn't want to disappoint them. So she sought an unsafe abortion, died a horrible death from pneumonia resulting from a massive infection. And her parents, who were this, you know, Midwestern couple, unlikely activists, instead of keeping the secret their daughter had taken to their grave, they spoke out against parental consent laws. But Amy, what I want people to really understand about these laws, all but 14 states had some form of a parental involvement for abortion law on the books when Roe v. Wade was overturned. That includes blue states. And so this was one of these policies that was popular, including in blue states, including among Democrats, and that the pro-choice movement didn't fight as vociferously from day one. And so, you know, looking at the death of Becky Bell, her death was preventable, you know, and that's the word that echoes from the ProPublica stories about the more recent deaths, Tierra Walker. Right? Her son JJ finds her slumped over her bed dead on his birthday of preeclampsia because she couldn't get an abortion in Texas. Candy Miller, her husband, finds her dead in bed next to her 3-year-old daughter because she was too afraid to seek follow-up care when she had a rare complication from a medication abortion in Georgia. Right? Portia Gumaizi, whose youngest child chases after women with braids on the street yelling, "That's mommy," because his mom is gone after she couldn't get miscarriage treatment in Texas. These deaths that are happening now could have been prevented if we had looked, if there hadn't been, you know, decades of Republicans using abortion as a political opportunity, Democrats surrendering too early, and, you know, true believers, many of whom I talked to for this book, building alliances with the politicians that they needed to accomplish these deadly policies.
As we begin to wrap up, who was Rosie Jimenez?
She was a 27-year-old Mexican-American mom of a 4-year-old living in McAllen, Texas. She had two Medicaid abortions in Texas before that were paid for, but after the Hyde Amendment passed, she could no longer get her abortion covered. And so she sought an unsafe abortion and died. Another horrible, painful death in Texas. She was the first victim of the Hyde Amendment, and I wrote about her first death and also her second death, which was the death that happened when the Hyde Amendment, the policy that killed her, was allowed to become such a mainstream, accepted part of our politics, renewed by every single Congress ever since.
Finally, Amy, as you research this book, what surprised you most? You've been covering abortion access for decades.
There were two motives that I found that many of the figures had that really surprised me. One of them was this guy, Paul Herring, I talked to, who wrote a first draft of the Hyde Amendment, this former IRS attorney. He kept trying to convert me to Catholicism by telling me, the most important thing is we go to heaven. I heard that time and again. So many of these men were telling me that they worked against abortion because they believed it was going to help them get through the door of heaven. I thought, oh my gosh, they have put women through hell so that they can go to heaven. And they have put the rest of us in hell, too, if you look at the news stories today, right? And the other thing that surprised me is just how much the anti-abortion movement was a reaction to the civil rights movement. Jennifer Holland, the historian, writes about how they created a civil rights movement for white people, a way that they could use social justice rhetoric and the right to life to avoid thinking about whiteness, avoid confronting white supremacy, and instead save the fetus, who they always imagined as white.
Well, it is a remarkable book, Killers of Roe. It's a revelation and also funny at times. Killers of Roe, My Investigation into the Mysterious Death of Abortion Rights. The book has just come out. Amy's abortion access correspondent for The Nation magazine. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Georgia Track.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
My name is Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day. And plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.